Libnim Reel 2?
Well, I was a bit unsure of how far exactly we were from Camilla Creek. I thought, well, the answer is call up a fire mission onto Camilla Creek, see where the rounds land, and bingo, you know, we can just take things from there. So we called the fire mission up, waited. After what seemed quite a long time, the rounds came down and they landed about 1,000 metres behind us. I thought, well, there's no way that I've overshot Camilla Creek House. Seriously wondering what had gone on, and so we called the fire mission again, got them to check all their settings. Rounds came down 1,000 metres behind us again. And this was something I just could not understand, and it eventually became clearer much later on that they hadn't got all the sort of met input that they would normally have, and that it was all put down to, you know, change of met. And, you know, they were now, I suppose, firing against the wind as opposed to with the wind or something, and it was making this sort of difference. So that really didn't help us too much, and it was really then it just became a question of, you know, proceeding with a certain amount of care and you know, trying not to blunder into Camilla Creek House. And eventually we got to the point where we thought we could see the outbuildings, and I then sent in one of my platoons, I think it was to our platoon, in to just see what the situation was, and they moved in, nothing happened, and the whole company moved in and occupied the place. And again, once again, lots of evidence the Argentinians had been there really very short time before, and looked as if they'd sort of bugged out in a certain amount of hurry, you know, the odd sort of half-eaten can of food still on a kitchen table and things like that. But as I say, you know, nothing there at all. So we made ourselves at home. It wasn't much space. We were in light scales, no sleeping bags. We decided that, you know, we would post sentries around the house and get as many people inside the house as possible. Take the risk that, you know, although we were all very concentrated, nothing was going to happen at night. And the battalion was following us down behind. And I suppose they arrived about 3 hours later, and we were all really quite comfortable in the main building with sort of 120 men or so. And it very quickly became clear that the sort of further 500 who joined us were also intent on moving into these buildings as well. And it became fairly crowded. And I squeezed one of my platoons into a sort of small downstairs loo, as I recall, and the whole battalion was crammed into these total of about three buildings, like sardines, to shelter from the elements and try and get some rest that night. And two interesting things happened, really. The first was that by now H was talking of an attack on Goose Green to actually recover Goose Green and Darwin, as opposed to his earlier briefing to me, which had been a raid. And the significance of this, I suppose, didn't really penetrate until, oh, really, many months later. But, you know, really, it is important. I'll explain in a minute. The other thing is that we were listening to the World Service and got this announcement, or report on the World Service, that John Knott had announced in the Commons that afternoon that there was now a parachute battalion within a couple of miles of Darwin and Goose Green. And H heard this and threw a complete wobbly, got Robert Fox in and berated him and asked what the BBC thought they were up to. I wouldn't blame the BBC at all. All they were reporting was what had been said in Parliament. But clearly, I mean, it was the best possible warning to the Argentinians. And if they were going to do their appreciation, it was pretty obvious, you know, the sort of areas we were likely to be. Either we were going to come in from the sea, or we were going to come down from the north. And, you know, fairly easy to cover both options in that sense. I mean, later, it became very clear that the Argentinians had redeployed in response to that, and therefore undoubtedly we met tougher opposition getting down to the settlements than we would have done. What was of immediate concern to H was, you know, that they would start to sort of draw rings around likely assembly areas and bomb them, and so therefore initially we were going to sort of spend the day sheltered from the elements in the buildings, and we all had to bomb burst out and disperse in the open, in the elements, for fear of air attack. Again, I'm not sure that that was necessarily the right thing. We could have all stayed concealed in these buildings, whereas once we bomb burst, we were visible, even though we were dispersed. Anyway, fortunately, you know, nothing in that way happened. There was no overflying by the Argentinians. We weren't detected. And we spent that day then conducting our own recces and trying to put together what, you know, we were likely to come up against. And at the time, to the best of our knowledge, we were told probably 300 or 400 in the garrison. We were getting sort of feedback from the odd SAS patrol who said, no, all you've got to do is, you know, knock hard on the front door and the rest will all collapse sort of syndrome. And people were taking it all very sort of relaxed in a way, you know, right, we go in, hit them hard, the rest collapse, we'll be straight through. By the end of the day, we'd captured one prisoner. One of the patrols captured a prisoner. The recce platoon had come up with a certain amount of detail of what was north, at least, of Darwin. And eventually, just before last light, we were called in to, by H for his formal O group. And I remember saying to my sergeant major, looking at the map and seeing there really wasn't a great deal of scope for manoeuvre in this narrow isthmus, saying, well, you know, either we're going to get them by surprise, it's going to be a cakewalk, or otherwise it's going to be a long, bloody day, it seems to me. And we went along to the O group, had our orders, marked up our maps with all the identified enemy positions, and there was just, you know, red from one end of the isthmus down to the other, as far as I could see. And I remember going back to planting my mark map down in front of my sergeant major and said, I think it's going to be the bloody one. There was no way that I could see this was going to be, you know, a piece of piss with, you know, all these positions to slog our way through. Unless, you know, really, you know, they just collapsed at the first knock, and that seemed to me just so slightly optimistic. I gave my orders in the dark, and we were due to set off from Camilla Creek at about midnight, as I recall now, 2 o'clock in the morning, I think. Crossing the start line at 2 o'clock, we left Camilla Creek at midnight. That should have all gone quite straightforwardly, but the order of march, I was right at the back. My orders were to be in reserve for the first two phases and then to move forward with B Company on phase three. And this was a six-phase plan for the attack, which was, again, fairly complicated for people to sort of get their heads around. Especially as we actually hadn't seen the ground. I think that was a fairly significant factor. Now, the trouble was, battalion headquarters was eventually going to sort of end up well to the rear once the battle started, but on the march down, they were put in front of me. And as we were sort of crossing the last stream before we get onto the isthmus of Goose Creek and Darwin, which I think is called Camilla Creek, battalion headquarters went static, and I then had to try and meander my way through this moving morass of bodies and radios and God knows what else. Came out the other side, missed the guides, and my lead platoon went straight on westwards instead of sailing south on the track, and we got slightly off course, about 500 metres or so. It was pretty obvious that we'd somehow missed the route, and I told the lead platoon to stop and sort it out where we were, got my own map out, took them back onto route. But the net result was we'd ended up in front of H's tack. And again, H, you know, believed in leading from the front and was most upset to find that his reserve company was at this stage ahead of him and proceeded to berate me loudly and in his usual way. There was no harm done, I think, except an affront to his pride that for a while at least his reserves were in front of him. The battle started, A and B Company, A on the left, B Company on the right. took their first objectives. A company without opposition, it seemed. B company, certainly sort of company minus, or that sort of platoon to a couple of platoons they had to attack. Again, listening on the radio, clearly not without without a great deal of opposition. And then H had gone stumping down this main axis track ahead of me, while B Company were reorganising over on the right, and who should have really sort of pushed straight on. And they were taking a long time to reorganise, and I couldn't understand why at the time. It came clear very soon after. And H, boiling over with impatience at this delay, and he'd set himself an extremely tight timetable, essentially 6 hours to fight through and get to outside the settlements, was if you like, the time plan, and then, you know, to actually attack the settlements once it was daylight because of the risk to civilians. Well, it was actually something in the region of 7 kilometres fighting through we had to achieve in 6 hours, which, as I say, really was very ambitious. Although at the time, again, we didn't think too much about it. There was still this sublime view, I suppose, that, you know, we'd knock hard, the whole thing would collapse, and we'd just steamroll her on. So when B Company's delay in reorganising really was fairly critical, H came stomping back, having actually sort of been already shot at, I think, from an enemy position ahead of him. Stormed back and said, we can't tolerate this sort of delay, and this was only phase two, I should have still stayed in reserve. You ought to go forward and attack that position. And I said, which position? Over there, I've just been shot at from that position, and I couldn't see anything in the murk and the dark at all. So this is clearly not the basis of a deliberate attack, and I decided the answer was just to advance to contact with one platoon up and hope for the best. And we called down a fire mission on what I thought was the objective from the ship's gun with a loom, thinking that would at least clarify things for us. The ship fired, I think, as I recall now, half a dozen rounds, one illume round, and then the gun jammed. So we were back in the dark and total confusion as we blundered our way towards this objective. Eventually we did realise we were heading towards an enemy position because we started attracting a lot of small arms fire from this small hillock. And really this was the first exposure, if you like, to danger, to the whole business of combat in these circumstances for the lot of us. And I think the only one in the battalion who'd really been in a comparable situation before was probably John Crossland. Despite what appeared to be an awful lot of tracer being fired at us, no one immediately got hit. And we managed to get onto the top of this hill and started to clear it with 12 platoon leading at this stage under Jim Barry. And we were suddenly opened up by machine guns on our right flank. And really, these machine guns were between where I was and the hill that B Company and John Crossland had already taken. And again, in retrospect, I think it was all part of the sort of same position, a large company position. These machine guns, really, on my right I had 10 platoon, on my left I had 11 platoon. And these machine guns completely pinned down 10 platoon at the point that really they were unable to move. They picked up two casualties almost immediately. And from where I was, I couldn't really come up with an immediate solution. I couldn't actually put down fire onto these machine guns without also firing onto B Company, who were just beyond. We certainly started to do that and got a sort of fairly urgent cry from John Crossland to ask what the hell we thought we were shooting at. And definitely, I've got to be honest, you know, I was caught, you know, really off balance and with a bit of a dilemma. And the day, if you like, was, or the night was saved by Chris Waddington, who was commanding 11 platoon on the on my left flank, who really, of his own initiative, did a sort of wheel round behind 10 platoon and put an attack in on these machine guns. And really, I have to say, with apart from me sort of saying, is there anything you can do about this, Chris, with no guidance from me at all? Chris had only been in the battalion about, as I call now, about a month, straight out of Sandhurst, and was already showing that he had a certain amount of flair for this sort of thing, I felt. And his attack went in very successfully. We suppressed the machine guns, but at the same time he picked up two other casualties, one injured and one killed, as they actually went in to attack one of these machine gun positions. I think they actually went to ground literally feet from it, realised where they were, and decided they just had to keep going. We then began to reorganise, and I then realised why B Company were had been so slow themselves, but it was absolutely pitch black. The ground at this point was really quite featureless. People had, in clearing the first position and then attacking these machine guns, had been at bomb burst, if you like, to the four winds. You know, if you like, following the line of resistance where the enemy were, they went. I mean, the whole business of orientation and staying aware of the direction you were facing, even let alone exactly where you were, you know, went to the four winds in the heat of contact. So people afterwards were clearly completely disorientated, and I then had to try and pull the company together and get some semblance back into the order. Complicated by the fact that 10 platoon were their two casualties. They couldn't, you know, only in retrospect we found what had happened. 10 platoon reported suspected two casualties, but essentially they had two people missing. So obviously we went through the business of trying to locate them. They may have been injured and needing assistance and so on. In fact, they'd both been killed. But at what point, and this is again something which is very often on exercise, if you like, not practice, at what point do you say, right, you know, forget it, you know, we can't find them, we must crack on and abandon them. There's a certain reluctance to do that. I think while we were actually going through the attack, we were all very clear, we stopped for no one. We got the attack in, we seized the enemy position. When we reorganised, we'd look after casualties. But, you know, on reorganisation, how long do you spend in the circumstances trying to find these people? The only other, as I say, problem was disorientation of the rest of the company, and the only way I could do it in the end was to put up a flare, which, you know, was not sort of tactical teaching you'd have at Warminster, and say, you know, reorganise on me on a clock ray method, and hope for the best. otherwise, I mean, we could have been wandering around each other all night. Eventually, when we got the company reorganised, we still hadn't found these two missing people. I said, well, you know, we're going to have to leave them. We must push on. And they were eventually picked up, I think, by battalion headquarters at daylight. Quite interesting that an NCO Corporal Corp had been shot very obviously first. And his buddy, Fletcher, was found lying on top of him with a shell dressing in his hand, and the deduction being that he was actually shot while he was trying to render first aid to Corp. Well, that's the way it goes. So I suppose we took probably, you know, I don't know how long, you know, half an hour to reorganise. I mean, it seemed an age, and again, age tearing his hair out, because you could see his time appreciation going out of the window. And eventually we got going, but by then, you know, A and B Company had once again been fed past us, and we were once more in reserve. And we stayed in reserve until really the Bocker House business, the middle of the next morning. A few things happened before then. As daylight came up, I was on a little knoll short of Darwin Hill, and A Company had already started the battle for Darwin Hill with clearly a great deal of difficulty getting anywhere. B Company had been brought to a standstill just as daylight was coming up, on the sort of extension of Darwin Hill, as you look westwards, but confronted by the Boker Hill feature, with a big open valley between them, a bit like a, you know, it's a billiard table, if you like, no cover at all. They couldn't move forward without coming under long-range machine guns from the Boker House Hill feature. So the whole thing had sort of plugged down very soon after daylight, and I was told to stay out of it on this knoll short of the Darwin Hill feature and stay in reserve. And two things happened. First of all, we saw Argentinians wandering along the western shoreline to our west, wandering south, presumably trying to sort of link, having been perhaps bypassed by B Company earlier in the night, trying to get back to their own positions. And so we amused ourselves by taking a few long-range pot shots at them. They were completely out of range, and it was clear that, you know, we were just wasting ammunition, so I put a stop to that. But it did register in my mind. And then, shortly after that, incoming artillery started to zone in on us. And you know, it seemed to me we were being adjusted, that we'd been detected by an observer who was slowly getting his rounds closer and closer to us. So I thought, well, this is not a healthy place to stand and stay. We've always been clocked. And despite H's orders to stay where I was, I decided to move into the lee, the northern lee of Darwin Hill, and try and avoid this bombardment, which I think was just as well, because literally no sooner had we moved off than a sort of significant fire mission came right down onto this feature. So that needed a moment of explanation with H as to why I wasn't obeying orders, but he accepted that. I then thought, well, we're not going anywhere very fast as things stand at the moment, and I, you know, the sort of thing of seeing the Argentinians moving down the western shoreline and moving out of sight came back into my mind. I thought, well, if they could move down there, you know, couldn't we? And if we can, and be concealed from the main Argentinian positions ahead of us, then there could be scope for turning this. And if we could turn it, clearly, then, you know, the Darwin Hill feature became, to my mind, virtually untenable. So I put this up to H and was told to mind my own business. Once again, we were spotted and the artillery started coming back towards us into the lee of Darwin Hill. So I thought, well, I need to move again. So this occasion I could see a sort of nice hollow further west. So I moved further west again towards the shoreline and established myself there, and was joined shortly after by C Company, who, you know, really sort of experiencing the same sort of problems. And again, from where I was, I could now have quite a good view of the shoreline. So to my mind, this was no longer just sort of, you know, speculative. I was now getting really quite convinced that there was scope here for, you know, at least a bit of exploration to see what, you know, scope was offered. And again, got up on the radio to H and said, look, you know, where I am now, you know, I believe there is possibility for, you know, infiltrating along the shoreline and possibly turning this. And at this stage, H clearly having a fairly frantic time around Darwin Hill, and fairly abruptly bit my head off along the lines of, don't tell me how to fight my battle, can't you see we're busy up here? So, well, all right, it's his battle, and decided that we really weren't going to be moving anywhere very quickly. And what could I do that was useful? And I decided by now it's going to be actually a very long day. I thought the most sensible thing was for the blokes to get a brew on. There was it seemed a sort of a strange decision to take, I think, certainly to a number of my men, but I mean, you know, rationally, there was nothing more productive that I could see we could do at the time. That you know, they need to get some energy in them and be ready to keep going until nightfall if need be. So we got a brew on, and literally my bowl of porridge had just come to the boil when we got the news that H had been shot. And the impact wasn't, I suppose, as people sort of talk about, you know, it must have been an awful impact. And I don't think it was, really. I think, you know, we were sort of in reserve. We were too far out of it for it to immediately sort of penetrate, you know, the potential significance. I always had this recollection that I heard him come up on the radio, his own personal radio, after he was shot, saying there's no one else to come up here. But I, whether I imagine that or not, I don't know, because everyone sort of says, no, he went down and that was it. It may have been an earlier conversation connection with something else, I can't remember. Anyway, we then got the word that, you know, he was out of the equation. And Chris Keeble started to take command some way back, and clearly unable to do anything immediately to sort of influence or to sort of get a personal grip on it. And I think he did the sensible thing, that Tony Rice was the man who was most obviously the battery commander, the most obvious person to take over as H's sort of right-hand man, if you like, intact. But it very quickly became clear that you know, he'd been embroiled in this sort of skirmish that H had been shot in, and really wasn't in a position to influence anything either. And so Chris delegated temporary command, if you like, of the battalion to John Crossland, who was, you know, obviously in a good position to see what was going on, control things, and at the same time told me to move up and join John Crossland and see what I could do to help him, which was an irritating order because I hadn't had time to eat my porridge, and I picked up this bowl of burning porridge and started to try and spoon it down on the move without too much success. Putting all those sort of personal admin details aside, we eventually got up close to John's position. I couldn't locate him precisely to go on to the same feature. Started to crest this ridge, and I could see eventually the enemy on the Bocker Hill feature ahead of us, about, you know, sort of 1,200 metres ahead of us. Thinking, well, we're out of range, we'll keep pushing on gently and see what happens. And then sort of suddenly heard some small arms fire whistling past us. And then my signaller got his thigh pocket shot off, and I decided that perhaps we were in range after all, and that we were being a bit bold, so we pulled back off this ridge. And I got on the radio again to this time to Chris and said, look, you know, we're stuck here, we can't go any further forward, but I've not yet committed. I can't find Crossland, but, you know, I do still believe that down on my right on the western shoreline there is scope for infiltrating round. And Keeble at this stage said, okay, if that's what you think, you know, go and look at it. So initially I sent down one section to have a look, and they came back and said, yeah, I mean, at least we can move so far. So eventually I moved down. I left one platoon on the hilltop to, you know, provide us a foot on the ground and, you know, to try and, you know, give us some fire support should we need it, and moved down with two platoons. And got within about 800 metres of the, probably a bit close, about 600 metres of the Bocker Hill position. And on the map there's a feature called Bocker House, which is in the valley, and the enemy position was up beyond that on the hilltop. I mean, there isn't a thing called Bocker House, it doesn't exist, it's just a, you know, sort of a couple of stones on the map, and a name on the map. And from there it became clear that we couldn't really move closer than that without exposing ourselves, but I thought, well, at least from here, you know, we didn't have heavy machine guns with us, but at least from here we could get GPMGs in the light roll within range. So I got all my machine guns down and lined up nicely in a sort of gallery type range situation behind a sort of small ridge down on the coast, and started opening up from there. And clearly within range, and at last, I think we were first people to get, you know, real fire effect onto the Bocker Hill position. Very soon after, again on John Crossland's initiative, the the support weapons have been brought forward, which should have, to my mind, happened a long time ago, or a long time before. And I think perhaps there's a reflection that, you know, H had got too absorbed with what was happening with A Company and not, you know, had lost perhaps that sort of perspective. But by then, shortly after I'd opened up my...